Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Manfred Steger and Ravi Roy, the co-authors of Neoliberalism, A Very Short Introduction, published in January in its second edition after 10 years by Oxford University Press. George Orwell once said that the word fascism has now no meaning except insofar as it signifies something not desirable. Neoliberalism knows exactly how the word fascism feels. As Professors Steger and Roy point out in their book, the term was first claimed by a group of liberal German economists in the 1930s to stress the importance of the state in ensuring efficient competition. But since Milton Friedman adopted the label in 1951, and governments of right and left conducted broadly aligned economic policies from the mid-1980s onwards, the word neoliberalism has become more of an insult than a precise description. What's new is that neoliberalism and globalization, which have been hated at least by parts of the left since the 1990s, have now also become swear words on the nationalist right, not only but mostly, but most notably by supporters of former US President Donald Trump. In fact, the recent experience of economic nationalism in government in the US, the UK, Italy, and Hungary has prompted calls for the N-word to be reclaimed. In a 2016 essay titled "I'm a Neoliberal, Maybe You Are Too," Irish economist Sam Bowman wrote, "I suggest we follow the suffragettes and wear this label with pride." But what does this label actually mean? Thankfully, we now have this well-timed, very short introduction to explain. Manfred Steger is Professor of Sociology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and Ravi Roy is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Southern Utah University. Manfred and Ravi, welcome both to the podcast.
Thanks for having us on the show, Tim.
Before we get into neoliberalism itself, I'm curious about the origins of the book. How does it work with these very short introductions? Did the publisher come to you before 2010? Did you pitch the idea to them? Who suggested the new edition and why? And finally, what did you change in the second edition? Because I've only read the second one. I haven't read the first.
Well, I think this is Manfred Steger. Again, thank you very much, Tim, for having us on your show. These are great questions, and I'm going to answer perhaps half of it and then switch over to Ravi, because it was really Ravi who's been the driving force behind the neoliberalism volume. I had previously published a volume in the very short introduction series that Oxford is putting out on globalization. And it's been actually a bestseller. So they've been very interested in getting me to write something else. And neoliberalism, as you pointed out in your introduction, is very much related to globalization. But I'm not as much of a political economist as I am a social theorist. So I understood that I had to team up with somebody who had more expertise in this area. And fortunately, my colleague and good friend, Ravi Roy, was willing to do that back in 2009 when we wrote the first edition, and that was published in 2010. And it sold well, and the publisher again approached us now 10 years later and asked us to do a second edition. Ravi, you want to take it from here?
Well, Manfred is being modest. His expertise in ideology made him quite the expert in neoliberalism, and it's something that he had been published well, and it's something that he is well connected with through his conceptualization of market globalism. And I knew this, and we became close friends very quickly, and he gave me a signed copy of his Globalization VSI book. And when I saw that, and there was actually some discussion of neoliberalism in that, and I thought, wow, this would be awesome, I think, very short introduction. So I called up Manfred, and Manfred, I'll never forget this. I pitched the idea to you, and you said, Ravi, that's the best idea you've had. All your ideas are good, but I think that's the best one. And so from there, Manfred was, as he says, already had a very strong relationship with OUP, and specifically the Very Short Introduction series, which is occupies a very special place at Oxford University Press. And Manfred was their star with the Globalization title. So I wasn't there for the meeting between him and the executive acquisitions editor, but I would imagine that went very well, because next thing I know, we had a contract.
So you wrote the first one immediately after the great financial crisis. I presume that was the catalyst for it. Am I right?
That's correct. But I think it even goes back a little bit further. If you remember 9/11 and the question of transnational terrorism, to what extent are social sorts of phases of instability, especially relating to questions of security and nation-state borders, becoming part of this whole discussion of globalization and the integration of global markets. So I think it goes back a little bit further, but as you point out, Tim, very correctly, it really came to a head in 2008 with the global financial crisis. And it was very, very clear that a lot of people out there understood that something was shifting. And they had thought that neoliberalism was this one, unified theory policy package. But as we point out in our book, there are variations of neoliberalism. It's truly global, and they're not exactly all the same. They belong to a family, but they're different. And our book was really premised on the idea of introducing people to what neoliberalism is about, but not in terms of one unified doctrine, but in terms of these variations. And that's why our book gets into the various applications of this doctrine in different contexts, such as Europe and North America and Asia and Africa and South America.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's as you point out, it's a very short book, but it does contain a lot of modern history. And while you assigned the neoliberal label to leaders from Thatcher and Reagan to Clinton, Blair, and even Deng Xiaoping, You make some nice differentiations, as you point out there. Like, for example, Thatcher was a fiscal conservative and Reagan wasn't. And you say of Clinton and especially Blair, there's this quote, the self-regulating market went hand in hand with cosmopolitan principles of universal democracy, freedom, and human rights. And this allied them with neoliberal institutionalists who opposed traditional foreign policy realism. Can you expand on these big differences?
Mm-hmm. Ravi, you want to take that?
Yeah, so the idea of welfare retrenchment, I think, is what unified that particular wave of, now I'm talking about late 70s, 1980s wave of neoliberalism among those Anglo-American leaders. But the thing that separated them was a very different reading or different internalization of having read similar sources. So, for example, both of them were suspicious of big bureaucracy. And that comes in part because Bill Niskanen, who Reagan relied on, in fact, he was the lead economic advisor in the Council of Economic Advisors to Reagan, but Thatcher had also read his book. And in fact, the book on bureaucracy that Ms. Gannon wrote is a staple in public administration on the conservative side. And she, I believe I've read somewhere that she actually made that book on bureaucracy required reading for every member of her cabinet. But coming from a monetarist viewpoint, she was very, and believing in the virtues of a strong pound first and foremost. That's kind of what directed her thinking about things like budget deficits. Whereas Reagan was not so concerned about the strength of the U.S. dollar. I think his sort of rather lackadaisical approach to a strong dollar was best summed up when I read somewhere where he said, well, what's wrong with a weaker dollar will make our exports more competitive. And he took that same kind of, I won't call it neglect of the deficit, but not so direct approach to the handling of the deficit. He believed, first and foremost, that getting government off the backs of private people by cutting, for example, marginal tax rates and cutting business corporate taxes, although in the end, as we point out, that's not necessarily what happened, but cutting business corporate taxes was the best way to free up entrepreneurial energy that would cause the economy to grow. It's through that growth then that would allow more revenues to be generated as an auxiliary to that growth that can then be used indirectly to pay back the budget deficit. So that kind of explains their different approaches to something like handling the budget deficits, but that was a salient issue at that time.
Yeah. I'm going to quote another neoliberal apart from Sam Bowman. This person said, most of the time, neoliberal simply means capitalist, although to varying degrees, depending on the pundit. What makes a neoliberal rather than, say, a classical liberal or an auto-liberal? I know earlier in the book, you identify these four dimensions of neoliberalism. Are those the differences?
I think to some extent those are the differences, and I think it might be good to get into those. But before we get into those four dimensions, for me, one of the big things about this prefix neo in front of this classical liberal ideal of of minimal state interference in the economy is the fact that what makes it neo is that capitalism went through decades of a phase that is referred to as controlled capitalism, or some people refer to it as Keynesianism. In other words, there were, starting in the 1930s with the Great Depression, and especially after World War II, there was a general consensus that capitalism had gone off the rail. It needed to be controlled. This notion of self-regulating markets did not work. It led to the 1929 crash and the ensuing economic crisis. And government had a role in making sure that the economy was, or capitalism was, functioning properly. And that meant that capitalism had to be regulated to some extent. And even conservative political leaders like Richard Nixon in the early 70s referred to himself as a Keynesian. So there was a general consensus that this idea of regulating the economy, that government had a role, that it was not about just hands-off, laissez-faire, free market agenda, was widely shared. So what happened, as Ravi described, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a real sea change in a sense that this idea of controlled capitalism was gradually given up. And what was neo about this liberalism is that, in a way, it was a new introduction of an old ideal in the context of relatively successful 3 or 4 decades of controlled capitalism. So the newness also refers to a phase or a form of capitalism that emerged after this Keynesian controlled phase or period.
Mm-hmm. Actually, can we come back to the four points? Because I'd like to follow up on a point on that main point you made. You in the book you rightly identify the 1970s oil shock as decisive in the switch towards this greater economic liberalism in the US, the UK, and Latin America. What do you think would have happened without the shock? Would economies have moved in the same direction but more slowly, or do you think things would have broadly carried on the same?
No, I think that it would have moved in the direction of neoliberalism. It may have taken a little bit more time, but as we all know, energy is at the very core of capitalism, right? I mean, you can't run capitalism without energy and energy policy. And obviously, the 19th century was the century of coal, and the 20th century is the century of petroleum. And if petroleum prices, literally overnight, as it happened in the 1970s, quadruple in 73, and then again, double, more than double in 79. So we're really talking about two oil shocks. This means that, you know, capitalism in a way has to move into a different phase that can accommodate what is happening here. So in that sense, I think that these oil shocks were really catalysts that you could call them great accelerators. But I think it would have moved anyway, because there were other signs that Keynesianism, controlled capitalism, was running into problems. And just to generalize all of these problems and put them in one basket, it would be that the profits of corporate capitalism, in other words, the profit of the big sharks of capitalism, of the big companies, and even small companies, were shrinking. And every time profits shrink, capitalism has to sort of reinvent itself, has to generate a new phase to return capitalism to profitability. So the shrinking profit base was there and would have anyway, I think, led to this sort of restructuring of capitalism away from controlled capitalism and toward this neoliberal phase. Hmm.
So, can we come back to the four dimensions? Because I think it's very useful to try and really narrow down what neoliberalism is compared to these other types of liberalism. Could you take us through these
four dimensions? Absolutely. Let's just think of neoliberalism as, you know, something like a jewel or a diamond, right? Which means that you can actually turn it around, and depending on the angle and the light that's being reflected, it might give you slightly different colors and slightly different optical sensations, but it's still the same jewel. So I'm arguing that there are, Ravi and I are arguing that there are four dimensions or four faces, four facets of neoliberalism. The first one is that it's an ideology. And what are ideologies? Ideologies are widely shared ideas and beliefs that are accepted as truth by certain groups in society, right? So they really serve as these conceptual maps or mental models, as Ravi points out in his work, that help guide people through, you know, what is a complexity of our political and social worlds. So they sort of form a simplistic but coherent picture of the world as they claim it is. And then these ideas and beliefs are being sold to a general public. And if they're successful, then most people believe in this ideology. So there's a certain consciousness dimension to neoliberalism as an ideology, as a thought system. The second facet of neoliberalism is what we could call a governmentality. And governmentality really is linked to the social thinker Michel Foucault, who talks about modes of governance that are based on certain premises and logics or power relations. So a neoliberal governmentality is rooted in the logic of entrepreneurialism, such as competitiveness and self-interest and decentralization. It celebrates individual empowerment. It celebrates this notion that a self-regulating free market should be the model for all proper governments. So it's no longer a question of government pursuing the public good, and that may be expensive, it may not generate profit, but since it's a public good, we might as well pay for it. It's the idea that government should run like a company, and it should be efficient, like an economic enterprise, And ultimately, it should generate profits. So there's this sense that government and businesses are really run by the same governmentality, by the same logic of market-oriented behavior. The third phase is, and we talked, I think, a little bit about that already, neoliberalism is also a concrete set of public policies. And Ravi and I talk about the DLP formula. D stands for deregulation of the economy. L stands for liberalization, mostly liberalization of trade and industry. And P stands for privatization of state-owned enterprises. So in other words, this DLP formula is something that most neoliberals, neoliberal governments, have pursued. They want to deregulate the economy, they want to have free trade, and they want to push for privatization of previously state-owned enterprises. We saw that, for example, in the UK, very much under Thatcher. And that's, of course, linked to the idea that we should reduce the power of unions. So union busting is part of neoliberalism, that we should reduce social services and welfare programs because people should sort of pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. We should have massive tax cuts, especially, as Ravi pointed out, for businesses and high-income earners. So this whole idea of public policies that are driving, in a way, what you could call a sort of a government off the back of industry attitude. And then finally, neoliberalism is also a certain form or phase of capitalism. I talked about this before. It's a phase of capitalism that follows Keynesianism or controlled capitalism. So we can see it in terms of a phase that has its own internal coherence and also a set of corresponding political and economic institutions that, again, and here comes the ideology, that reinforce people's belief in the naturalness of this particular form that we call neoliberal capitalism. So all those four together, if you put them together, I think you get a more holistic picture of what neoliberalism is, and it allows you to talk about mental models and very concrete, pragmatic policies without necessarily involving yourself in a contradiction because you're arguing they all belong together.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, given those dimensions you've set out and the history you set out in the book, why do you think the term has become so associated in the public mind, certainly in the last 5 to 10 years, with the center left, with Blair, with Clinton, with Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers, etc.? How would you explain that?
Ravi, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think, as my colleague Mark Blythe said some years ago, I think it was in an interview, he said, neoliberalism as we know it, and he was writing in 2010, I think, may have germinated or began with the new right of Reagan and Thatcher, for example, but it blossomed under, and I got to be careful here because the new left means something different in the American context from the international one, but with the third way, new left under Clinton and Blair. And I think this has to do with a transformation of what we think on both the left and the right of what creates wealth. And I think that the shift towards financialization, or the shift towards specifically financial institutions or the financial sector away from manufacturing, that happened to occur from, you know, post-1970s right through to the 1990s, the logic of what creates wealth was very sympathetic with this idea of a government that at once takes its hands off of the finance sector and lets the finance sector do whatever it needs to do through deregulation on the one hand, but on the other hand, subsidizes big business and big finance in ways that it hadn't previously. And in answering that question, I'd like to just quickly revisit. You asked the question, what's neo about neoliberalism? Yeah. I'm talking simply now about the intellectual and ideological conceptualization of the term neoliberalism as distinct from classical liberalism. If we associate for a moment, let's just associate classical liberalism with Adam Smith, for whom that's known. We'll take something, for example, like inequality and the role of business. In classical liberalism, at least according to Smith and his followers, liberalism was about getting the state, getting the monarch, getting the political state out of the affairs of the market. So it's about a free market in which it's an empowerment of both both consumers and producers to find a way to negotiate, you know, free of the interference of government and find an equilibrium, and then the market clears and life is good. And in that process, Adam Smith is very clear that inequality is a detriment to society, and that what is happening under that system that he was writing at that time was that the state was coming down on the side of business and consumers and labor were being exploited in that process. Now we come to neoliberalism, and it's a different kind of thing. It makes no apologies for inequality. It makes no apologies for the state supporting business and subsidizing business when it suits it. Thatcher even used to say, "What difference does it make if the rich are getting richer relative to the poor? As long as the poor are absolutely better off under this new system, then that's okay." She did not see a problem with inequality in the way that Adam Smith did.
But wouldn't that same attitude apply to countries that would be considered, for example, by, say, Bernie Sanders as democratic socialist countries? So I'm thinking of countries like Sweden or Denmark or the Netherlands, where they still have inequalities. They still, I mean, in the case of Sweden, very liberal economic structure. The difference is that they have a very large state, so, and large taxation. And if you lose your job, you go into this. You know, your welfare payment is very high, but it's limited for a year. So I'm trying to narrow down the difference. You know, what is very specifically neoliberal compared to social democratic or ordo-liberal. Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. So in the case of, as Manfred said, the neoliberal cannot be understood without the controlled capitalist era. So that's a huge piece of this. It's a revisitation of some of these older ideas, but recast it in a new way. What I would say is that one of the things that's happened out of these social democratic countries is they are less social democratic than they used to be. And that has a lot to do with the imperatives of neoliberal globalization. And so even in the case of Sweden, you know, they have some of the lowest corporate taxes, if not the lowest corporate taxes of any industrial democracy. And while they do that, you're right. They subsidize healthcare. They have laws about the disparity between the salaries of the officers of a company and the lowest paid worker in that company or organization. So they have found their own way to deal with neoliberal hegemony, if you like, which is to make their organizations leaner and meaner and or allow that to happen on the one hand. But the thing that they've been able to retain to a certain extent, although they've made modifications as well, we've seen welfare retrenchment, even in the case of Sweden. And all of that is a part of this neoliberal transition.
Right. Tim, let me just take a very brief crack at it again. I think that what your audience should understand is that every time capitalism runs into a crisis, the question then becomes, what can we do to get out of this crisis? And it usually starts with ideas that then have to get translated into policies, right? So in the 1930s, the ideas of what can we do to get out of this horrible Great Depression came predominantly from social democracy, from labor. They won the battle of ideas, and they said, in the words of John Maynard Keynes, is we have to create a different kind of thinking about the economy in order to pull out of the problems that we find ourselves in. And as a result of that, winning the battle of ideas over the next few decades, we saw, the age of controlled capitalism. Now, in the 1970s, capitalism is running again into a systemic crisis. And again, the question becomes, what can we do basically to save capitalism or to make capitalism work again? And this time, it's the conservatives. It's Ronald Reagan, and his advisors. It's Margaret Thatcher and her advisors who have ideas that turn out to be the ideas that get translated, picked up by, chive with voters, get picked up and get implemented. And I think what we're seeing now, and this might move us into this sort of last phase of neoliberalism, which is, the last 10 years since the global financial crisis, is that these ideas are no longer salvageable in their totality. Some of them have survived. Others have really run aground this cliff of the 2008 global financial crisis that then led to what you could call the explosion of national populism and populist politics around the world. So the core here is what's really new about liberalism is sort of a reinvention of how capitalist and the capitalist economy can work based on old principles, classical liberal principles, that we don't fully take over, that we have to twist and turn, but we can find inspiration from those ideas.
Yes, I'm struck by what you said about the explosion of populism globally. I think some people are taking the experience of the last 5 years as a sort of object lesson in what they think they may have given up. And you're seeing some people actually turning towards what you would describe as neoliberalism as a golden age. I presume you think that's a mistake.
Yeah, I do think that's a mistake. And I think that in many ways, it's a little bit like, the old adage that you can't step into the same river a second time. And I think it's the same thing here. There's a certain kind of a logic that calls out for, and I think it makes a lot of sense, calls out for new ideas, calls out for new policy applications. And I don't think, you can just go back and say, well, let's resurrect neoliberalism with a more human face, and that's going to ultimately defeat these new forms of populism, of nationalism that we're seeing in the world. I don't think that that's the way it's going to work. At the same time, I think some ideas of neoliberalism so powerful and apparently still workable that even national populists like Donald Trump or Jair Bolsonaro or Viktor Orban, have picked them up and carried them forward in spite of their nationalism and anti-immigrationism. So that's an important development, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in this respect, I was very struck at how critical you were of the Barack Obama administration. I mean, you say he turned a blind eye to monopolistic practices by big tech and financial services, and even the healthcare plan was designed in the interest of insurance companies. But I was most interested in this idea that he represented, or, you know, he was the figurehead of a third wave of neoliberalism where, quote, human agency and decisional authority is increasingly subordinated to big data-driven algorithms. That's very interesting. Can you expand on that?
Ravi?
Yeah, I think in the case of Barack Obama, he was kind of a victim of his time. These things were already in the mix. And as Manfred and I were talking earlier with one another, Barack Obama did not have a clear policy agenda. He had a leadership agenda, but he didn't have a policy agenda, and he deserves a break, because he was inheriting a political economy at a time that was going through many things, not just the financial crisis, but the underlying current that supported it. It was this other great revolution in human invention and productivity, which was, you know, the new tech economy. And it had largely evolved, you know, through startup minded mentality. There wasn't any strategic, I think, vision for how that unfolded. And I think it all happened to come to fruition at a time when the financialization processes, which again were driven by these high-tech financially engineered models, were beginning to expose their weaknesses. So he had all these things upon him when he came into office. So I just think that he wasn't prepared. I don't think he had the technical expertise at his disposal, or the anticipation that all these things would happen. So I think he was more reacting to these forces, these overwhelming forces, that were just a point that all culminated at a particular time in history. I don't think it's any secret that what he ultimately ended up settling for in the case of healthcare was something that Congress would be willing to pass and put on his desk. And so that's exactly what he did. And there's all kinds of stories of and speculations over why that was. We don't really touch on that, but this is the result. It largely was driven by the insurance companies. It's no accident that it looked his healthcare plan that he ended up signing looks very much like the one, the pro-business one that came out of the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, if I can jump in at this point, yeah. I think Ravi makes good points, but I would be a little bit tougher on Obama, and also point out that he was a Democratic Leadership Council president. In other words, he believed in basically the same neoliberal third way approach that Bill Clinton believed in. And if you look at what he surrounded himself with, you know, Timothy Geithner, for example, as his first Secretary of the Treasury, these are all people who are linked to the roaring 90s and this kind of third way neoliberalism. And when he had an opportunity to actually reshape capitalism in a perhaps more controlled way, in other words, to reimpose some controls on capitalism, he absolutely did not want to do that. And what he did is he basically bailed out finance capitalism, and that caused a lot of anger. That caused a lot of anxiety. And you have the origins of the Tea Party in the United States. I think you even have the origins, if you globalize this, of the Leave campaign in the UK with regard to Brexit. This anger and resentment, this politics of anger and resentment, really emerged when people realized that instead of providing massive help to people who had lost their house, who could not pay their mortgages, who had lost jobs, most of the money, most of the bailout money went to the finance industry. That's when Obama put his cards on the table, his economic cards on the table. And it was clear that he was with industry, that he was with corporate capitalism. And I think that the right at that point shifted tremendously. And we're still living through that phase, because what happened is that from a party, a conservative party that was oriented towards big capital, the conservative party shifted towards the working class, particularly the white working class. And it was Donald Trump who exploited that to the max. And that's still the kind of ideological landscape that we're inhabiting now. A reconstructed, a reconfigured conservatism away from this, corporatism and towards, especially rhetorically, towards a white working class.
At the same time, of course, it is pushing other people who were traditionally, say, Republican or Conservative Party voters in the opposite direction, in the direction of in inverted commas, sort of the neoliberal golden age. Can I ask you to follow up on the third wave? I mean, this is inevitable because it is a very short book. This is not to complain, but I'm just interested. Where you say that the third wave of neoliberalism is this period where human agency and decisional authority is increasingly subordinated to big data-driven algorithms, you clearly have a sort of vision of a potential neoliberal future. Could you try and outline that?
So what I would say is what we're looking at, and this is where globalization comes in, I think, in a massive way. Because we have to understand, of course, and this is the point we're making in the book, that neoliberalism is a global phenomenon, right? So what we have to understand is that if you think of neoliberal globalization or global neoliberalism in the 1990s, and you try to associate a concrete concept of phenomena with it, right? It probably would be something like free trade, right? It probably would be something like global value chain. Right, the rise of retailers like Walmart, where you have cheap production in the global south, particularly China, and these commodities, these goods, get disassembled in different places in the world, and then they enter the consumer markets to kind of bring down prices. You can go to Walmart and or Woolworth or whatever it is, and you can buy cheaply, much more cheaply than you could do that before. So globalization primarily was about what you could call objectified globalization in forms of commodities and trade. And what has changed is that increasingly globalization is moving from this objectified or embodied form of mobilities to digital forms of mobility. In other words, we're talking about precisely, information, data, ideas, that get transmitted, of course, amplified through social media, algorithms, AI, telecommunication, all of those things, office work, remote work, and so on and so forth. In other words, what we're seeing is a cannibalization of embodied, objectified globalization by disembodied digital globalization, which means that capitalism is moving more and more into cyberspace, more and more into this world of disembodied world of, data mobility. And that means that for neoliberalism, this new phase will be one in which you could, there are books out on that. You could talk about things like data capitalism or digital capitalism, or some people, critics call it surveillance capitalism because of all the sort of surveillance technology that goes along with that. And I think ultimately we're moving, and especially now with COVID-19, right, which is a great catalyst for making things even more cyberspace oriented than they were before. We're moving into a phase where neoliberalism is becoming more and more disembodied, where people spend more and more time in cyberspace, more and more time in making money, in working, through digital networks rather than in person at home. We are now at a point in the United States, believe it or not, in 2021, where 27% of the workforce is working from home digitally. So I think this is where neoliberalism is going. And it has its pluses and minuses, right? I mean, the big minus is surveillance, authoritarianism, the ability of manipulation, the fact that we are no longer having these sort of social interactions that we used to have in an embodied form. And, you know, of course, the advantages is flexibility. Advantages is that, you know, you don't have to commute that much anymore. You can actually spend more time at home and you can be more of a sort of a architect of your own time. But it's going to be this direction, I think, that Ravi and I are arguing we are moving into.
Yeah, and just to add to that, part of this disembodiment that Manfred so eloquently laid out is also contributing to the removal of human agency. That's what John Kay talks about in his book, Other People's Money, The Real Business of Finance, is that we are seeing with the intentional abdication of human agency over to these algorithms, to these AI. We are losing something fundamental in that process. And as the neuroeconomist Paul Zak so has been able to demonstrate, one of the things that AI cannot do and why it will never be able to replicate human decision-making is AI will never be able to replicate human empathy in the way that human beings interact with one another. So this disembodiment is leading to the further disenfranchisement of human beings from connecting with one another. And it's the lack of that human connectiveness that's actually contributing to the degradation of human agency and human and the strengths that all that involves in decision making over our financial and political future. As we intentionally give that away, we are in fact giving away an important piece of who we are. And with that, as I said, the big piece of that is the empathy that no computer will be able to maybe able to mimic it, but never be able to fully internalize it and be able to make decisions on the base of it, because computers are just not empathetic in the same way that humans are biologically.
Well, with that dystopian outlook, we will wind this up. And to finish, I've asked both of you to, in advance of the interview, to recommend a book each and to explain your choice. Ravi, you go first.
Yeah, I just mentioned the one, Other People's Money, The Real Business of Finance by John Kay. From the point of view of looking at this third wave of neoliberalism as being big finance, this book has helped me in so many ways conceptualize this issue. The other one is The End of Alchemy, Money, Banking, and the Future of the Global Economy by Mervyn King. And one of the books that I've relied on to that sort of gave us a glimpse at this was a book written by W. Evers Debing called The New Economics for Industry and Government and Education, which was almost 30 years ago when he wrote it. But he sort of warned us about this this problem of giving away human agency. Now, W. Evers Debing happened to be writing at a time when we were moving from manufacturing-based, the logic of manufacturing-based wealth creation, to this kind of financialization that we are in now. But if you look at the system of financialization, it's an incestuous system, and we need to bring human agency back into it and be able to think, bring in people that are capable of looking at the problem from a systems level. So it's those three books I would recommend.
Thank you. And Manfred?
Well, you were asking us, Tim, about the future of neoliberalism. I want to take us back to the past and actually suggest a novel written by one of my favorite novelists, Robert Harris, and it's called Imperium, and it's about the late Roman Republic.
And it's actually love that book.
The first book in a trilogy that really lays out the life of Cicero, or it's built around Cicero's life. And what I really love about it, aside from the fact that he's such a terrific writer and such an an enjoyable and fascinating style, what I really like about it is it shows how many of the problems that we think are really the problems of our time, of the contemporary age, whether it's finance, whether it's government, whether it's even human relations and human agency, actually are problems that have been around for a very, very long time. And he lays this out very convincingly in this trilogy. And I think offers us a wonderful framework for understanding our time as not necessarily as unique as we think it is. And that means we can really learn from the past. And that for me, you know, I'm a big, big history buff, and I love historical novels. I think that's one of the real great ways of thinking about the future through the help or bringing in the past.
Okay. Well, today I have been talking to Manfred Steger and Ravi Roy about their Neoliberalism, A Very Short Introduction, published in 2021 by Oxford University Press. Ravi and Manfred, thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you, Tim. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Tim. This was great.